And like when we live based on a lot of shoulds, we're living a life that feels out of alignment for what is actually meaningful to us.
You're listening to The Self-Worth Edit, the podcast inspiring South Asian women and beyond to quit playing small and start trusting the power and wisdom within. Join me, Nosheen, on Mondays as I share insightful conversations, tips for healthier ways of thinking, and lessons in healing our relationships with ourselves. Thanks for tuning in to The Self-Worth Edit. Here we go. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Self-Worth Edit podcast. I hope you've been enjoying this season of the show as we've been joined by guests including Aparna of Indian Matchmaking and Natasha Ibrahim, who I met on a beach in Costa Rica in 2021 and who taught us that failure leads to success. If you haven't listened to the other episodes this season or earlier yet, what are you waiting for? We have more than 50 episodes for you to listen to while you wash dishes, do your laundry, have a cup of coffee or chai, commute, or whatever it is you do as part of your podcast listening ritual. If you've been enjoying the show, have you left a 5-star rating or review yet? You can now rate this show on Spotify. So if you're in the Spotify app, just look under the logo image on the left-hand side, and you should see a button to rate the show. You can also rate and review on Apple Podcasts, and while you're at it, go ahead and subscribe so you never miss an episode. This season, I'm also sharing a unique journal prompt to help you go deeper in your learnings and reflection for each episode, so follow the link in the show notes to sign up for the newsletter and get access to those prompts. All right, today's episode is an interview with Divya Robin, who is a New York City-based mental health therapist, making mindset hacks more accessible to all through her Instagram profile and reels over at Mind Matters with Div, which I will link in the show notes. Divya shares with us her path to becoming a mental health therapist, and we dig into the topic of adult loneliness, what it is, where it stems from, and how to cope with it. We chat about unique mindset blocks that face South Asian women and women of color more broadly, as well as where and how to begin with mindset work and much more. Let's dig into it. Here is Divya. I read on your website that you knew from the young age of 11, was it, that you wanted to be a mental health counselor. Did you ever waver from that along the way?
Surprisingly, no, which I know is very different from, honestly, I think like 99% of the stories that I've heard. Prior to the age of 11 or 12, I had always told people I wanted to be a doctor. And I think a lot of that was just cultural priming and that I was very much encouraged to be like a medical doctor. And so I always had told people that answer. I almost feel like it was like this robotic pre-rehearsed answer that people will ask you at parties and things like that. Oh, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And so I would say that. And I think the first time that I really pondered on it a little more was when I was doing a project for my 6th grade class. We had to write a paper in English on what we wanted to be when we grew up. And there was this piece of me that just like really was not interested in being a doctor. I think I knew that. And I knew a lot of it was for pleasing my family and following traditions. And so I had looked up on Google and like researched what other topics were. I remember I had to like ask for permission to go on our computer because it was one of those like very big computers and only like one person in our family could go on it at a time. So I said, I have to do work for a project. And so I Googled professions and I read about being a counselor, and something about that was really, really impactful. And so I wrote my paper on that. And I think it was the aspect of supporting people, being there for people. It just really stood to me. And I think the more that I grew into wanting that, the more I learned about psychology and human behavior, I really saw in my South Asian community how much that was needed and how there was such a big gap in people talking about mental health. And I didn't know any therapists. And so that's been a really big thing too, like paving the way of that, because I remember when I wrote my paper on that, my parents were like, what would you do? And I don't know, I think they thought it was a phase. And I remember even in college, they thought it was still a phase. But, you know, here I am. And
That's so funny because this reminds me, we had a similar assignment around fifth or sixth grade too. And I definitely wavered from mine. I think I wrote about wanting to be an FBI agent. And you could say I've gone a little bit off the beaten path with that one. So I love that you found your thing so early and stuck to it.
Yeah.
So what areas do you specialize in?
So I specialize in anxiety, mood disorders, life transitions. I work primarily with young adults and adults in their early adulthood, which is typically a stage defined as the years of like 18 to early 40s. There's a lot of transformation and transitions that happen during that time and a lot of finding of yourself. And so that's something that is really rewarding with supporting people during that time. But in terms of my official training and what I have in clinical training, it's a lot around anxiety. I work with OCD and mood disorders and trauma.
And how did you land on all of that? Because that's a broad range.
Yeah, I work a lot with evidence-based modalities. And so there are a lot of really supportive evidence-based modalities for anxiety and OCD in particular. So I kind of started off more in that range. And then with trauma, similarly, I got training in that as well. And that's been something that I think like most of my clients that I've had come have had some element of trauma in their lives. And I think just as a society, even if you look at us like over the last 2 years, the collective trauma we've experienced, I think that is something that a lot of therapists should have some type of training in because it's something that inevitably like comes up a lot. And so that's where my trauma work ended up getting more intertwined in my clinical work.
And who are you outside of your work?
Outside of my work, I am a huge dog lover, which I'm, anyone who like follows me on my Instagram probably sees my dog a lot. I'm a big dog lover. I like to spend time with my loved ones, my husband, my friends, trying new things. I live in the New York City area, so there's always new things that you can try. And recently we moved over to New Jersey and we have our car now, which has been really wonderful because New York City, we're like foodies. So I like to go and try restaurants there, but we also like having our car because it's had us be able to explore New Jersey more. And there's a few like trails around the area when it's warmer, obviously. Now it's quite cold, so we don't go exploring, but usually trying new things. That's something that I've really found myself doing more over the past couple of years. I did a lot of what was the same to me typically. And recently I've been exploring more and trying new things.
And then you're also sharing mindset hacks and tips on Instagram with your amazing reels. So how did you get inspired to do that?
Well, what had me start my Instagram page was I wanted to reach a larger audience in terms of especially like people who didn't have that kind of mental health education. Like I was really thinking about what do I wish I had growing up? And while I was growing up, social media was like not as much of a thing. So I didn't have that kind of resource really at like the tip of my fingers. I don't know what it would have been like if I did. A social media used to be a space for me where I felt like I compared myself a lot to people. And I just saw a lot coming on with looking at people's big houses and like their cool outfits. And I just wanted to shift the space a little bit. And I was like thinking, what do I really wish that I would be able to have seen when I was scrolling on Instagram or if I was scrolling on Instagram at that age? And so yeah, I started posting more about mental health because that's exactly what drew me to the field, was wanting to minimize that gap that's in the South Asian community specifically. And I say South Asian community because for me, that has been my lived experience. But I know in many spaces, especially in the BIPOC community, they share somewhat similar stories as I do. But I wanted to be able to spread that word into people's homes and onto their phones in ways that like maybe they don't have those conversations at home with their families, but like to also know that what they're going through, they're not alone, and having some kind of person saying that to them. So I think like when I feel very stuck on what I'm doing, I think about like what I wish I had when I was growing up and when I did feel alone in my mental health. And so I felt that posting on Instagram would be a way to bridge that gap a little bit more.
I love that. It really does make it so much more accessible, especially with how taboo seeking therapy has been in our culture, right? And so yeah. I think we're coming a long way. Recent generations are coming a long way on that front and really combating that taboo. And for those who still are not there, to be able to have access to that free educational and inspirational content is so meaningful. And it was one of your reels that made me want to reach out to you. It was one that really struck a chord with me. Your reel on adult loneliness. So what inspired that particular reel?
that particular reel, and I know which one you're talking about because it's really been one that I think has reached so many people, which has been so validating for me too, because that's been something I've experienced a lot in transitional periods. And I think going back to what I said with the population I work with, that it's primarily ages like 18 to early 40s, there are so many transitions happening during those phases, and people are unlearning and they're relearning and they're outgrowing friendships and they're navigating new jobs and relationships and spaces and roles. And, you know, there's a lot of loneliness that comes with that. And I think in our society, especially, we talk a lot about during that time that we're thriving and you should be thriving. And I think that puts us in this box of feeling that we should be feeling happy and inspired and enthusiastic and successful at all times. But that's really not the case. And a lot of the time it's really filled with loneliness, because when we're in new spaces and facing new opportunities, which is a lot of young adulthood, you don't really know how to navigate it. And so I really had seen one in my clinical work that that's something a lot of people experience. It's something that I've experienced, and it's something that's not talked about very much, because I think there's so much stigma about saying that you're lonely. And so we really don't talk about that. So that was what inspired me to do that. And honestly, I remember posting that and I felt like it was kind of vulnerable, because a lot of the examples I shared in that were personal examples. So that's how I'd come up with the content in that reel. And it really seemed like it resonated with a lot of people. And so that was really validating. But yeah, I think that that's what really inspired me to do it. It was coming from the heart, but it was also something that I knew needed to be talked about. And a lot of people just weren't talking about it.
Can you say more about the stigma around admitting loneliness?
With being lonely, there's such a misconception that loneliness is being alone. And I think that when we say that alone physically and not having people to talk to or not having people in your life, and sure, there are some periods of time that we don't and we might not really know our people. But I think that because human beings are social beings, we're like meant to connect with one another. And so when we don't have that connection, we almost feel like a failure, or we feel shame about it because we're wired to be that way. And so I think that's where a lot of the stigma comes from, loneliness in general, and even like personal shame. And we have stigma, internalized stigma, about feeling lonely, because especially with what we see, I think social media makes it a lot harder, because we see on social media people in their relationships and with their friends. And sure, people are only posting their highlight reels, but I think that can really contribute to this feeling of shame and stigma that comes with like, what's wrong with me? It's what I've really heard a lot of the time from people when they feel lonely. And even I felt this at times too, but feeling like something is wrong with you. But like, why do so many of these people seem to have really meaningful connections in their life, which we don't really know what it is, right? Just having people in our life doesn't mean it's necessarily a meaningful connection. But I think that's another topic. But in general, I think that's a really big reason why we face stigma with loneliness, because we're meant to be socially connected.
Yeah, the thing about social media is so interesting and so true. And I definitely contributed to maintaining an image for a while, right? Which is why I now speak so openly on the other side of it. But I definitely was married. I was posting about having a husband. I had certain connections and friendships and relationships in my life that a lot of that fell apart because it was a surface level thing, right? You're not showing what's underneath. And there's a reason I did it too, right? Because I also wanted to feed into the narrative of, hey, look, I'm not alone. And so you mentioned that typically people think of loneliness as being physically alone. What actually is adult loneliness?
Adult loneliness actually stems from feeling a lack of like meaningful connections. And the really hard part about that is just because we have relationships in our life, it's about how we receive connection. So like how each person receives connection is different. And that's what's a really hard transition in relationships, is because how one person receives connection, let's say that you to feel really deeply connected and need authentic, real conversations, right? Like some people just need things that are deeper than what's on the surface, and they need vulnerability. And if another person is hard for them to be vulnerable, the one who desires that vulnerability, they're not going to feel meaningfully connected to the other. And like, that's where loneliness can come from. It's not really about not having people in your life or the lack of the physical presence of people. That's social isolation, but isolation and loneliness is different. Loneliness is an emotion and isolation is a physical state.
Wow. That's a really important distinction, I think. Mm-hmm. That's where it comes into play, right? Like if you're comfortable being alone and you have times that you're comfortable in isolation, versus you can be in isolation and feel lonely, or you can be in isolation and not feel lonely. It's fascinating.
Wow.
So I suppose, like, how do you recognize it and address it if you're facing loneliness?
I mean, just because loneliness is really stemming from the connections, like the authenticity and how meaningful connections are, that's really the first place to start. And you were so vulnerable and open and talking about just now about how you kind of fed into that narrative. And so many of us do. Like, we want to feed into this narrative that we have these connections. And just because we have a connection doesn't always mean that we feel we can be authentic. We really feel like we're seen and heard and understood for every part of us, flaws and all. So what I always say is to first, like, think about what the authentic you is, because, like, how can we show other people our authenticity and be loved for that authenticity and respected and seen if, like, we don't even know how to show that authenticity in the world? And so that's really a first place to start, is understanding what deeply connects you to even yourself. What are your needs? What is important to you? What are your values? And then finding spaces and relationships that accept those as well, and being able to feel connected in those kind of ways, because that's how true connection really is built.
It's reminding me of an interview we did for this podcast on the authenticity principle and recognizing what that is. And I'll link that in the show notes too, because that's such a profound thing, right? Like, how can you show up and even begin to build connection without knowing who you are? And for many of us, at least in my experience, I didn't even know that I didn't know who I was until way later in life. The experience I had growing up in our community is that it's so communal and it's so focused on the other, and there's a little bit of a disconnect with self. So what I'm hearing from you is, like, connection to self comes and then connection to other can come. Is that right?
Well, I think that they can coexist, and it's normal that, like, we don't always feel fully connected to ourselves. And it doesn't mean, like, that has to be a prerequisite to being connected to others, but it definitely can strengthen and foster the connection with other people, and, like, us to be able to receive deep connection because we know what we're really looking for in relationships.
When you were talking about being able to receive and the different ways people receive, it reminds me of the 5 love languages.
Mm-hmm.
Does that factor in here at all?
Yeah, it definitely plays a big role. And it's funny because when I've talked about loneliness, that's something that I hear a lot, is people bringing up the love languages, right? And it's a similar concept, because just because my partner has a certain love language, if he loves me in that way, I might not receive it the same way that he would receive that, because that's how he receives love. But how I receive love is different. And so it's the same thing with connection, because to connect with another person and have them really feel seen and valued, that is also different, and we have to be intentional about it. So connection comes with, yes, understanding what it means to have authentic connections, but it also comes with intentionality, because it might not always be easy to have. And I think that's what also is hard the older we get. And that's why I really talk about young adult loneliness, is intentionality plays a really big role in those kind of, in that area of life. You know, things are convenient. People are in school together. They're taking the same classes. They're predominantly on similar life paths. And once we usually hit 18 in our society, people start doing different things. And especially after the mid-20s is when people really are in different stages of life. Some people are, you know, married, and some are having children, and some are just starting their first job. Some are really not sure what they want to do with their careers. And, you know, all of it's valid, but at the same time, it also makes it hard to connect, and people feel profound loneliness during that time too.
And it's so funny because we all experience it, and I don't hear it talked about all that much, that transition period. And then I see it show up in different ways for even our younger employees where I work, because you've just transitioned out of this environment, like you said, when you're kind of in the same lane as everyone around you, doing the same thing, thinking maybe similar ways.
Yeah.
And now you're kind of on your own. And so that's fascinating to me in terms of how that plays out and why it's not being discussed more and what the support service is.
Mm-hmm. It's really under discussed.
Okay. When we think about South Asian women and even women of color more broadly, are there any unique elements that come up with regard to this topic of loneliness in particular, or no?
Yeah, one of them is exactly what you had just said, is I think, especially with the communal aspect, when it comes with being growing up in a society that is more collectivistic versus individualistic, which is, like, typically Western cultures, understanding your own needs and what it means to connect for you can almost feel selfish. And that comes with this parallel process of unlearning. And so I think that's what can make it really hard, is to be able to really learn more about yourself requires unlearning some of these internalized ideas. And that can come up too with worries about feeling selfish or that you're doing things wrong and having to do boundary setting. And so it's not really like this easy process. It's not that just like one day you wake up and are like, I'm going to learn more about myself and connect with myself in an authentic way. There are all these steps, and it's really, really painful to have to understand what has led it to be so difficult to do that. So I think that's definitely one of the first ones. And I think inevitably too, with just being a person of color, I mean, I'm speaking from living in the United States of America, we are a minoritized population. So like most people around you, they have different lived experiences, and it doesn't mean that you can't connect to them. The more you add intersectionality to it, the more that you have your unique experiences. Like, I'm a first generation immigrant. And so my lived experiences and how I connect in the world is going to be different to other people, but it's about the intentionality of, can they still see me for who I am? And I think that it's really hard to feel authentic in a lot of spaces as a person of color, because, you know, we just want to belong, we want to fit in. And so a lot of the time that comes with giving up authenticity.
That feels heavy. The thought that's running through my mind is that just, that feels heavy.
Yeah. It's almost like this catch 22. You are being authentic, but that might come with loneliness too at times, when people around you aren't able to really like understand or see and validate that. But then also trying to fit in and like giving up these authentic pieces of you also feels lonely. And so it's navigating that whole process is incredibly tough. It is really heavy.
Where do you begin to navigate that? Like you said, catch 22.
I think definitely is a process, and it's not overnight. It's like how we talk about anything with healing and unlearning and outgrowing. It's a process, and it's not like it's a place you get to and you're like, that's it, I'm here. But allowing that space, I think that loneliness also comes with a lot of emotional growing pain. And so before we have these authentic connections, or we feel more comfortable in our own skin, in a way of like being authentic about our values and needs, there are these growing pains of like anxiety that's going to come up when you speak your mind, or like grief that's going to come up when you outgrow spaces. And a lot of the time it feels worse before it feels better. And I think that's like one of the really, really tough pieces about it. And so I think to be able to understand and start to venture on that process, but by also being realistic about what that journey looks like. I think a lot of the time we look at healing and trying to find ourselves in the same way that we look at things like going into adulthood, that, oh, I should be thriving, that it's like this one-dimensional process when it's not that way. And so the same thing with healing and starting to learn about yourself more, it's a multidimensional process that comes with these really painful emotional growing pains also while you're finding pieces of yourself. So I think we need to start looking at it more in this multifaceted way.
Yeah, I really like the realistic picture that you're painting of it too, and the focus on the unlearning as a verb too, that has to take place first. And it is, right? Like when you see a lot of content on Instagram or out there about healing, yes, there's an acknowledgement that it's hard, but that's not what we necessarily capture visually. What we capture visually is almost the after effect of, you're sitting in this Zen environment, you got a journal, you got a candle going, and all of that is beautiful and it can feel wonderful. But when you see that, it inspires feelings of peace and it neglects the feelings of everything else that you just mentioned that happens in the process.
Absolutely.
Oh, I love the call out on that. So zooming out a little bit from the loneliness piece even, or maybe not, maybe we'll come back to it. But when you think about South Asian women and women of color, have you seen any unique focus areas that if women were to focus specifically on doing mindset work around these specific topics, it would be especially beneficial when it comes to South Asian women and women of color?
Yeah, I think like definitely prioritizing needs is so important, because there are two ways, right, that women of color can experience this. One, when they're coming typically from more of a collectivist society of like self-sacrifice, that like you doing things for your community. You're not doing things for you. You're doing things for your family and to honor those around you. And then in another space, like when you go into white spaces where you are the minority, is like also pleasing those around you. You want to fit in, especially in work environments. You want to be like other people because you want to be in the group. You want to be getting that promotion. You want to be accepted. And so that also goes sometimes with sacrificing parts of you. So I think a lot of being a woman of color and having both pieces, especially when you're a person of color and you're a woman, that you're used to like the self-sacrifice and doing it almost without even realizing and trying to fit in and trying to people please. And that's a really common reality that a lot of people have shown up with, just because the norms, like societal norms too, if you look at the gender norms of like, who is the one who's usually the caretaker, who is the one who will change when there's an inconvenience and someone needs to adapt. It's usually the woman. And especially when you add being a person of color to it too, there's more complexities. So I think the first step in any kind of taking care of your mental health is starting to face that discomfort that comes with taking care of yourself and prioritizing your needs, because that in general is what stops a lot of people from taking care of their mental health, because they're like, this feels wrong, or this doesn't feel good, and shouldn't this feel good? But I think it's when having that kind of mindset also negates all this lived experience as to why it's uncomfortable for you to take care of yourself. So I think that's really the first place to start, and to normalize that and start to experience some of that discomfort so you can work toward making space for it.
The question that comes up for me is, how would you recommend that someone become comfortable with staying in that discomfort, especially when you have a, for lack of better words here, like a distorted sense of what is right and wrong, and you're grappling with that, and it doesn't feel good. If it doesn't feel good, does that mean it's right? And how do you make sense of all of that?
Yeah, that's a good point, especially when it's new territory you're navigating. You don't really know, like, what am I supposed to be doing? I don't even know if there's a way they're supposed to be doing. It's what works for you. But I always say, start really small. Let's say that you're used to accommodating for everyone around you. And the first time when your friends or your partner or someone is like, oh, what do you want for dinner? Instead of responding, I don't care, you choose, being like, no, I want tacos, like saying what you want at work, stating a boundary of, no, I can't respond to this email at this time. I'm going to need to get to it tomorrow. Or I have plans tonight that I won't be able to work late. And starting to be small in areas that you can start to prioritize yourself. And it doesn't have to be like this whole thing of fully feeling uncomfortable in every situation, because you're just going on a whole spree of just taking care of yourself, even though you should be. But starting to normalize that idea a little bit more and starting slow, and getting comfortable in areas where it feels more comfortable to do it. And so whatever that looks like to any person is to start small and to gain more comfort. It's kind of like a muscle, right? Like you want to strengthen that muscle, and it's not like you're going to go to the heaviest weight and do the hardest thing. You're going to start small. And so the same thing is with working through guilt.
I love the tangible examples. So thank you for that. And what I'm thinking as you're saying that, and I'm thinking of 11-year-old you, is, have you always been a master at mindset work? Has this just like come naturally to you, or was there like a turning point for you?
It has been something that is something I've always thought about. I do know for me, a lot of it growing up was, I was very much the caretaker in a lot of like dysfunction around me within like family settings, cultural settings. I was like always that person that had been the one to listen and the one to take care of situations and the one to fix situations. And the older I got, the more I've had to step back from that role, because, you know, that takes a toll on anyone and it's really tiring. And in the same way that I was almost like forced into that role of like understanding and realizing emotional states and recognizing how situations impact our emotions, I think that I was able to take a step back and observe how these things were happening and like seeing patterns, right? Like even of dysfunction or chaos, this is a pattern, or like this thing keeps happening and this is how someone reacts, and like seeing where those things came into play. And that was something that for me ended up being something that I was very observant with, like human behavior. And I think I always had this piece of me that just had like this intuition. Like I knew when people were off, or I knew when something was going on around me, and I was able to sense that. So I think that that was already something that was like the skill And then the more that I started to dive into the field of psychology and research and doing clinical training, I think that already having like that skill as a human and like some of those just innate characteristics, those helped my clinical work and being trained. And my, so I really attribute a lot of it to like my lived experience, but then also obviously my clinical trainings and graduate work and things like that.
Yeah, it's interesting how some of those difficult lived experiences can give you some of your superpowers and your talents if you know how to harness it. Thank you for sharing that. So in your field and research and training, have you come across the most difficult mindset blocks? Is there a category of these are the most difficult mindset blocks?
I think the one that comes to mind immediately when you said that is working through a lot of what ideas that we've internalized, and that's what gets in the way. And the way that a lot of the time I have people identify is when we use the word should, that's usually rooted in this internalized idea of something that we're doing. And it might like, it could be aligned with our values, but maybe it's not. It might be like an expectation from family or culture or society. And like when we live based on a lot of shoulds, we're living a life that feels out of alignment for what is actually meaningful to us. And so I definitely would say like living by our internalized ideas and internalized beliefs. And that doesn't go to say internalized beliefs don't serve people. They might. And that's the thing, is that's why it's important to be reflective and to notice how our internalized beliefs shape our behavior. Because it doesn't mean that just because you've internalized this idea, it's misaligned, but it could be. And so it's important to be reflective on that, and also to have compassion that it's okay to unlearn some of those ideas.
How do you recognize the misalignment? Because I like the idea of should. So when you find yourself saying, I should do something, that's a kind of a cue and a signal that, hey, there's something internalized here. Okay, so now I want to go to determine whether this thing that I've uncovered with this cue should is in alignment or not. What's a question that I should be asking, or what should I be thinking about?
Like, how does it feel to you? And like, what are your values? I think a lot of it goes in line with values and understanding what is meaningful to us. And it kind of goes back to like, even my story of like, when I was 11 and telling everyone I was going to be a doctor, was because that was based on societal expectation and cultural, actually, and familial. So like many of them all at once, and also gender, because just being a caretaker, I think in some ways are with being a woman, but understanding what's meaningful to me, what are my passions, what are my strengths, and being able to combine that and making decisions based on that as well and factoring that. So being able to look at it from this more holistic sense instead of only looking at it based on what is internalized in our mind.
Do you have any go-to books or resources that are your favorites when it comes to mindset work?
I love practicing through acceptance and commitment therapy. So it's ACT. There's one book called The Happiness Trap, which I really, really love. That is a good one when it talks about living based on your values and doing things in alignment to what is purposeful for you. So definitely that. If anybody is looking toward understanding their values more, I would definitely recommend trying ACT therapy, and that modality in general is very much based on values and alignment and making decisions based on what is meaningful and important. And it also has a lot of emotion regulation techniques. That's where I do a lot of my practice based out of when working. The Happiness Trap is a really good place to start when starting to parse out like what we do as a society and how we stay stuck in these internalized beliefs.
Do you have a favorite emotional regulation technique that you use either for yourself or for your clients?
The easiest one that I always recommend is to just take a pause. Like, there's so much power in that pause. When there's any kind of situation, we have an emotional trigger, we can either react, and a lot of the time our reactions are impulsive and our reactions are rooted in our fears and our insecurities and what immediately comes up for us, versus when we take time. And I've even sometimes suggested, like, literally put a timer on your phone for 10 minutes. Like, you're feeling overwhelmed, step away from the situation, put a timer on your phone for 10 minutes and then come back. And oftentimes when you do that, you're going to be able to intentionally respond. And it's going to be different than that reaction. So that's a really good one to be able to just like even regulate your nervous system during that 10 minutes. You're going to respond so much better.
It seems like such a simple thing, but it's one we don't make time for often enough. And one that I could easily see us saying, I don't have time to pause for 10 minutes. But what's the harm that happens when you don't? And what's the possibility of the direction you could take things if you do? So that's great.
I think a lot of it goes with the fact that our society is like such like we want this urgency and we want to do things immediately. And that's not the way our brain works. An easy way to describe it is we have like two parts of our brain, right? We have like this emotional part of our brain and our logical part of our brain, and like they can work together. But when we're feeling emotionally activated, primarily like this emotional part of our brain is reacting, and like we cannot think logically. So we need to take that step back. But it's hard because we live in this society where like taking a step back is not an option. We got to keep going, going, going. And that's why we end up reacting so emotionally most of the time. And it's not a fault of our mind, because it's like we need to work with our mind, not against it. But this urgent society and like how we need to have everything done immediately, that doesn't really serve the way that our mind works. So that's why it's so important to be able to take those steps back.
Yeah. And I think that's such a good way to honor yourself and such a good way to create a boundary of, in this world that's pushing me to be urgent, I know I owe it to myself and the people I care about and the people I work with to take that pause. So truly it does make such a big difference. The times when I've practiced that myself, I show up as a different human and people recognize it too. You know, people recognize it too. So, okay, before we get into all of the ways that people can connect with you and work with you, is there anything that I haven't asked you that you want to give voice to?
When it comes to the adult loneliness, I really want to just emphasize to people that they are really not alone in it. With any types of transition can come loneliness, because we're experiencing something new. And when we're experiencing something new, the way that we connect with ourselves and the way we connect with other people shifts. It's the same thing as I tell people that situations change, our coping styles need to change too. So it's like the way you coped in the past might not be the same way you're coping based on a different situation. And the same goes to transition. The way that you connect to yourself and the way you connect to other people will likely not be the same as you're in a different stage of life. And so that's why during this young adulthood, and I'm not saying that loneliness doesn't happen during later stages of adulthood. I think if we learn how to cope with loneliness and like transition in these ages of 18 to 40 and like, or even 50s, it would greatly impact us in the later stages of life. So I'm not saying that loneliness doesn't happen. I want to definitely clarify that it's normal and you're not alone, because we're kind of meant to experience that loneliness, right? You're navigating something new. So the way you connect with yourself is going to be new too, but like really starting to prioritize how to connect with yourself and how to connect with others, and to know that loneliness doesn't have to be a permanent state. I think the more compassion we give ourselves in normalizing that loneliness, the less we have loneliness become a permanent state. So I think that's something that I just really want to normalize and to be one of the takeaways.
And I think the thing that I really took away from that when you were talking about it earlier is the fact that you felt so vulnerable and exposed sharing that reel and how it resonated with so many people. And so that real life example of connection too. And to double down on your point that if you're feeling this, you really are not alone. A lot of people are resonating with it.
Absolutely.
I love it. I love seeing all of the work that you're doing. I love that you are making these topics so accessible and so fun and inspirational and connected. So in addition to Instagram, which we will definitely be linking in the show notes so everyone can check out your amazing reels and tips, how can people connect with you, work with you? Where do you show up most?
Definitely on Instagram, on my website as well at DeviaRobin.com or MindMattersWithDiv.com. You can see my website if you look at the link in my bio on my Instagram. The link in my bio on my Instagram also has some free resources. I have any kind of courses, workshops, any offerings. I also post in that section and on my website. So definitely Instagram is a place to look, and my website has everything as well. And if you'd like to get in contact with me in any way to work with me or any other reasons as well, you can look at my website and I have a contact page on there.
Perfect. We will link the website as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been such a great conversation. I'm glad that we're talking about this more, because like I said, the more we talk about it, the less lonely people will feel.
Beautiful.
Thanks so much for tuning in to today's episode. As always, if you got value out of this or any other episode, go ahead and send it to a friend to listen so they can benefit from it too. Bye for now.